Well, we're coming to the climactic moment of the Exodus story. If you've been with us last few weeks, you know that we've been working through and studying this great story that's in the Old Testament as God tells his story of how he rescues his people, the Israelites, the Hebrews, out of slavery. That the story began with God calling this one man named Abraham, making a whole ton of promises to Abraham. And then as he made these promises to Abraham, God formed this man eventually became a family, had a baby when he was really, really old. And that miracle baby grows up to be a family. But that family ends up in Egypt. And then we have 400-year gap. That family becomes a great people, but this people is under a horrible, horrible slavery at the hands of the Egyptians. Egypt was the most powerful, most wealthy nation on the planet at this time in history. The Nile River fed into the Delta Basin there and just created the most rich, prosperous nation on the planet. It also became the most powerful, and for millennia, for hundreds and even a thousand years, was one of the dominant world powers. And now they have enslaved an ethnic slavery with the Hebrew people. And we come to this climactic moment in the story is now God has been promising he's going to act. He's raised up this man named Moses, but now God is going to act. And he is going to act decisively, and he is going to act in such a way that even today, here we are, 3,000 years later, we are still saying there is one true God, and he has shown himself in this story. We're going to see that over and over and over again in this account, that God says, the reason I'm doing this is so that you will know that I am the Lord. It is so that my people will know that I am the Lord. It is so that Pharaoh will know that I am the Lord. It is so that the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And literally, God a couple times says, and I am doing this so that people for thousands and thousands of years will know that I am the Lord. He is going to act in such a way that when the story's over, no human can take credit, and God has acted decisively. But it brings us to a hard issue, and we're going to wrestle with that this morning as his action is against these people who are involved in injustice, in slavery, in genocide. And so it is an act of judgment, and we're going to wrestle with the God who judges this morning. So what I want you to do is I want you to grab a Bible and turn to Exodus chapter 7. We are going to deal with this thematically. We believe in teaching the whole counsel, the whole scriptures. But sometimes when we're preaching stories, the best way to preach this is to preach the story from more of a 30,000-foot view. Instead of going through each plague and preaching each plague over a series of weeks and reading every scripture, we're going to kind of look at the first 9 of the 10 plagues this morning and try to say, what is God teaching us about what he is doing in the whole story here? And so I'm not going to read all of chapter 7, 8, 9, and 10 this morning. That would be a long, long reading to which I'd probably have to get to the end and say, and it was nice seeing you. Hope you come back next week. What I'm going to do is read a couple selective sections right now, just going to read them with you or for you, but you alongside reading it in your Bible, in your app, on page 43 through 46 in the Bibles we have at the end of your rows. And then I'm going to kind of just talk about what's taking place in the story and what it teaches us about our God, what it teaches us about ourselves, and what it teaches us about the world around us. That's kind of what we hope to do this morning. So grab a Bible, and because this is a weighty section in honor of the God who is and his word, I'm going to ask you to just stand with me as I read a couple passages from chapter 7 through 10. I'm going to read the beginning of chapter 7 that sets the stage, and then I'm going to read the entire story of the plague of the hail in chapter 9. So we'll get to that. Chapter 7, verse 1, it says, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet.'" And like God doesn't mean that Moses is a god. He's literally saying, you are going to go, and everything you say to Pharaoh is going to literally be my words. You are going to be speaking on my behalf, and you will be acting in my place towards Pharaoh. "You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go out of this land, but I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply the signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring back my hosts, my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt. by great acts of judgment, the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. When I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the people of Israel from among them. Moses and Aaron did so and did just as the Lord commanded them. Now Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. Now flip over to chapter 9. I can still tell those of you who are using an app and those of you who are using an actual book Bible, can't we, right there? All right, chapter 9. And we're going to begin with verse 13 there. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, rise up early in the morning and present yourself before Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, let the people go that they may serve me. For this time I will send all my plagues on you yourself and on your servants and on your people so that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth. For by now I could have put my hand out and struck you and your people with pestilence, and you could have been cut off from the earth. But for this purpose I have raised you up to show you my power, so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. You are still exalting yourself against my people and will not let them go. Behold, about this time tomorrow, I will cause very heavy hail to fall, such as has never been in Egypt from the day it was founded until now. Now, therefore, send, get your livestock and all that you have in the field into a safe shelter, for every man and beast that is in the field and is not brought home will die when the hail falls on them. Then whoever feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh hurried his slaves and his livestock into the houses. But whoever did not pay attention to the word of the Lord left his slaves and his livestock in the field. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven so that there may be hail in the land of Egypt, on man and on beast and on every plant of the field in the land of Egypt. Then Moses stretched out his staff toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire ran down to the earth, and the Lord rained hail upon the land of Egypt. There was hail and fire flashing continually in the midst of the hail, very heavy hail, such as had never been in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. The hail struck down everything that was in the field in all the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And the hail struck down every plant of the field, and it broke every tree of the field. Only in the land of Goshen there were people of Israel. There was no hail. And when Pharaoh sent and called Moses and Aaron, he said to them, this time I have sinned. The Lord is in the right, and I and my people are in the wrong. Plead with the Lord, for there has been enough of God's thunder and hail. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer. Moses said to him, as soon as I have gone out of the city, I will stretch out my hands to the Lord. The thunder will cease, and there will be no more hail, so that you may know that the earth is the Lord's. But as for you and your servants, I know that you do not yet fear the Lord. The flax and the barley were struck down, for the barley was in its ear and the flax was in bud. But the wheat and the emmer were not struck down, for they are late in coming. I'll just sidebar right there. What in the world does that mean? It means that God purposely sent the hail so that they wouldn't starve. He took out one season of crops, but not both. There's grace there, just so you know, okay? So Moses went out to the city from Pharaoh and stretched out his hands to the Lord. And the thunder and the hail ceased, and the rain no longer poured upon the earth. But when Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased, he sinned yet again and hardened his heart, he and his servants, so that the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he did not let the people of Israel go, just as the Lord had spoken through Moses. And so here is Moses speaking. You may go ahead and sit down. Here is Moses speaking on behalf of God. And the language is most of the time as Moses is talking is in first person on behalf of God. God is the one who is telling Pharaoh what is going on. And he is telling him that he is sending acts of justice and judgment to deal with what is going on, to deliver his people, but also to bring judgment on the Egyptians. And on one level in our culture, we don't like this kind of talk. We don't like the judgment talk. We don't like a God who is a judge. In fact, it's like the number one defeater belief in our culture. You know, already maybe some of you are going, oh, there we go, here we go, the God of judgment, God who religion could use him to manipulate people to get what they want to, the God who judges. But the truth is, all of us have down deep inside of us the reality that justice matters, and we want justice to happen. And there's no better way to show this than to show you how we respond to certain movies and certain people. So I'm going to show you some photos up here, and I want to get a little more audience participation. I'm not going to come down, but see if I can get some help. I need you to tell me who this is. And if you don't like the person, like, I want to hear you boo well against the people you don't like. All right, so here's a picture for you of somebody from the movies. Here we go. Do we like him? Who is that? Emperor Palpatine, okay? Now, we know, like, he is becomes the central figure in all six of the first Star Wars movies, like, right? So if you're, like, not a Star Wars fan, you're like, I don't even know that guy, but I can look at him and go, he is not right. Like, there's something wrong with him. And how does he meet his doom? Haven't seen the movies. All right, little note, there are spoiler beliefs here. It's like, if you haven't seen this yet, my bad. Yeah, Darth Vader throws him off of a balcony down into the pit of this ship, and we know that he blows up and dies. And how many of you, like, stopped and wept at that moment? No, you're like, yes, the Emperor got his. He needed it. All right, next guy. Who's that? Who we got here? Biff Tannen. And, like, Back to the Future, bad guy. And he's bad in every movie in every way. In fact, we go back to the 1700s, and he's still there. Like, somehow Biff, his great-great-great-grandpa was just as bad as he was and looked just like him. It's amazing. And in every movie, the big way that he gets his just due is what? He crashes into either a cart or a truck full of manure that dumps into his car or his chair. He gets it every time. How many of you all went, oh, that's a shame? I feel so sorry for Biff. No, he's the bad guy. We don't like this guy. All right, how about this guy? Or lady, who's this? Boo. There wasn't a whole lot of boos there because here's why. Some of y'all have gone seen Wicked. You're like, oh, but they're telling you their side of the story. Wicked's propaganda, okay? I hated that whole thing because they tried to make her good. No. And how did she meet her doom? Come on, let me hear you in her voice. I'm melting. Right, she gets water thrown on her, which I always thought was hilarious. Like, you are the Wicked Witch, but a little water gets on you and you melt? Anyway, you know, we know not to be afraid of her anymore. Just, you know, bring my water bottle, we're good to go. But nobody, like, boo-hooed over that, right? We cry when Toto's in trouble. She dies, we're like, yes! All right, next one. Yeah, this one, like, most of the rest of them were, like, lighthearted, and then we see this one, and we're like, ooh. I really don't like him. You know, and he gets his end, right? Batman drops him, and he goes to his doom, and you know, it becomes part of the story. And once again, there's just like, almost like relief when justice is served. All right, here's another one. Who's that? Yeah, Mother Gothel. What movie are we from? Tangled. Yeah, all you guys are like, I've never seen that lady before in my life, and even if I have, I'm not admitting it. Right? Yeah, she's like really dark and sinister from the get-go. And how does she meet her doom? She fell out of the tower, right, yeah. And like I said, once again, nobody was like, oh, she's lost her mother. No, we like justice being done. I think I have one more for you, don't I? Two more, all right, here we go. Who's this? Yeah, it's Khan from the first Star Trek set. And the second Star Trek set, I thought I'd throw both pictures up because, you know, they've kind of rebooted Khan. And now, I can tell there's like four Trekkies in here. Because most of you are like, I don't know who those people are. That guy looks like the guy from the Island movie, the Island show, right? Fantasy Island, yeah. That's who that is, but he's dressed really weird. I don't know who he is. But if you're a Trekkie, you know this is Khan, who's like the ultimate nemesis, the ultimate bad guy. And he meets his doom in both movies. How does he meet his doom in the Star Trek movies? Blows up on a ship, yep. Which is how everybody moves their doom in the Star Trek movies, I think. So, all right, we got one more here. Who's that? Principal Rooney, right. And how does he meet his, how does he get justice? He has to, yeah, the dog gets it, but the real one is when he has to get on the school bus at, like during the credits of the movie. And all these little middle school kids are just looking at him thinking, what is wrong with this guy? And he like, he now has to, he's the whole movie, he has been oppressing students and specifically Ferris Bueller. And now a bus full of middle schoolers give him his just due. See, there's something in us when we watch movies. We know that if there is somebody who's broken, who is wicked, who is evil, who is just been terrible all through the movie, we are okay with the ending if they get their just due, and frustrated if the evil and wickedness is not resolved by the end of the movie, right? Let me tell you something that you may not know about yourself. The reason you feel that way is because the imago Dei, the image of God, is in you. That God has a settled disposition that wickedness and rebellion and injustice and horrible things cannot reign and cannot win. We talk, as we read the Bible and read the very words, and we talk about the wrath of God. And that term like makes us nervous. It makes us uncomfortable. But what the wrath of God, it literally just means that God is in his goodness, has a settled disposition that he will not let evil reign. He will not let injustice rule. He will not let the wickedness that is in this earth and the horrible things that go on in this world be the final word. He's a God of justice who deals rightly with the broken, messed up nature of this world. And what happens as we read the book, the story in Exodus this far, we see some pretty bad stuff. We see a horrible, horrible slavery that is purely ethnically based. And here we are. I mean, we know. We go see Selma, and we know that this stuff is not okay. We see infanticide as they literally, just to maintain their position of power, their place of prosperity, they throw babies into the Nile River and kill them. The Hebrews, we're told in chapter 1, are literally building storehouse cities, which means that the work they were doing was to build cities that was for the purpose of taking the overflow of the prosperity of the Egyptians. They're using slaves to build downtown Las Vegas and the casinos. They're building slaves to build their Disney World. They're using slaves to build the Times Square in New York. That's what the slaves are doing. Storehouse cities. And what happens is, as we read the story, we're like, man, we want Pharaoh to get his, but what about all the innocents? But what happens is the story begins to untangle this, and as the story is told of how God is dealing here, the Bible has been very clear in the text to tell us there's no such thing as an innocent Egyptian. Like, one of the things we have to deal with when we look at things like the Holocaust, and we deal with things like African-American slavery in the United States, and we deal with where there is, like, you know, in the Middle East and ISIS and things that are going on now, or North Korea and places, is how far down does the guilt go as God wrestles with the guilt of people and decides to act decisively? Because what we want to do is say, well, God's unjust here. He should have just got Pharaoh. But let's deal with Nazi Germany. Just, I want you to think about this for a minute. Is Hitler guilty? Should he get what's coming to him? What about people who are in who are just serving as guards in concentration camps? Sure they are. What about people who are living in the premier cities and they are profiting and benefiting even though they never put a Jewish person on a train? What about Germans who are benefiting from the culture wealth, but they're just living in their house, but they do nothing? See, at the end of the day, we know that if you don't stand up for injustice, you are part of the problem. We know this. And this has already been born true in the text, as it's told us that all the Egyptians despised the Hebrews, and all the Egyptians were involved in carrying out the commands of Pharaoh, and all the Egyptians were part of the story here. And what the Bible's, it's already kind of in the story shown us that Pharaoh is the linchpin here, and he's got his cronies underneath him that are involved in this story. But every Egyptian is benefiting from the slavery and the injustice, and every Egyptian on some level is involved in what is taking place. And therefore, as God brings justice, he is acting against Pharaoh, but he's also acting against the whole culture, and he's doing it in such a way that is decisive so that the whole world will know that he is the Lord, there is no other. Now, like I said, some of you already are probably wrestling with this. If you're a skeptic, you may say, listen, I have a hard time with a God who judges, a God who acts like this. It sounds like something that religious people create and form so that they can control the masses. And we've seen a lot of places where Christians or so-called Christians use the idea of the judgment of God to point fingers and to deal with things. And even sometimes the people who have been the loudest finger pointers, we find out they had a secret life that was a mess and were involved in sometimes the very same things that they were pointing fingers about. And so you reject it, like, man, I'm not going to buy into this. I'm not going to buy into a God who judges and all that sort of stuff. Some of us, though, come from a tradition where, like, we're on the religious side of this equation, and we've been part of churches, and even we ourselves, who we're like, yes, God is going to judge them, and we have really, we create the list of the ones that God is going to get, right? We know who they are. We know where they hang out, where they gather, and what they stand for. And you know, we have marches, and we have certain things that is our way of saying God is going to judge you because of this. We know this because we read the Bible and we see what he did to the Egyptians, and we do this in such a way without any humility, without any grace, feeling like we are like morally justified because we are the good people. We go to church, we do our stuff, we're patriotic, we pay our taxes, we give to the church. We're not involved in those crazy activities, therefore we're okay, and if we can get those people judged and get it over with, America would be okay again. And what I want to tell you is that both those approaches gets me out of the crosshairs. It gets me, like, I don't have to deal with the judgment of God because either I'm not going to believe in a God who judges, therefore I can just pull myself to a side. I love the idea of a God who is going to make things right. Like, I like a, like sex trafficking is really, it's a huge, massive issue. And a lot of people are getting involved in how can we make a difference in a world where people literally go into villages in Nepal and pay their parents to take their 8 and 9 year old little girls back down to train them and do school in the city, where the whole thing is a scheme to take their little girls and get them to the age of 12 so they can turn them into prostitution slaves in the cities of Nepal. Like that, we want a God who does something about that, but not a God who does it in such a way that he judges those who are involved. Like, we don't want judgment. We want God who is a loving God who will make a difference in issues, but not in a way where he opposes the evil. And that's our culture. But the flip side of that is that those who are like religious, our way of dealing with this is it's always the other people who are involved in these activities who need to get judged. And we don't really get our hands dirty in the issue. We just know that the people who are the cause of the issue ought to get theirs. And the story of the plagues is showing us a God who is rescuing his people, but he is doing it as he literally acts on their behalf, but against the injustice that has been done to them. But what he is trying to do is give them a heart where they love justice, but they also love mercy. And we cannot really call ourselves followers of Jesus if we don't get that. If we run from a God who judges, the end of these stories are terrible. Like, I just think about this. If God doesn't act in judgment, what's the end of this story? Are people really going to be convinced in a broken and fallen world from loving preachers who offer nothing but grace that they need to cut it out? And if you haven't figured out yet that no, evil will get worse and worse and worse, and sometimes even human attempts to stop what's going on in the world. I mean, good grief, the Middle East right now with the ISIS thing ought to be exhibit A for us. They're like, we're dying because we don't, there's no human solution to this. There's no way to stop this right now. We can't come up with a plan. And to think that we can tweet and blog and think that people in ISIS are going to go, oh, I never saw it from that perspective. That's just not going to happen. We need to cry out to a God who acts in this way and hope that he will stand against the wickedness in the world. But if it doesn't create mercy in us, where our hearts are moved with compassion towards the brokenness in the world, and we're just like shooting God will judge you bombs from a distance, we don't get the gospel either. God is forming a people who understand both. And so the story of the plagues is the setting where God acts, and Moses can't stand up and say, I did this. Aaron can't stand up and say, I did this. At the end of the story, the whole purpose, over and over and over again, God has said, I am going to do this. I'm going to do this in this way so that you will know that I am the Lord. There is nobody like me. The whole earth is mine. I govern everything. Your gods are not enough. Your powers are not enough. Nothing can stop me when I choose to act. That's the story. And so we have 10 plagues. And what happens in here teaches us a lot about the heart of God in the midst of judgment and even in the gift of redeeming his own people. And so there's like a rhythm in the stories as God does these 10 plagues. And each one, I mean, we kind of listed them up here for you. When I teach this in my Old Testament class, I teach some of the material here and I say, listen, I am not going to try to require you to know all 10 plagues. I am this morning not going to give you another list of them. You saw them on the screen. That's why we went ahead and showed you a video. We saw how they were and what happens. But there is a rhythm as each plague comes to pass, as each plague happens. We saw it as the plague we read through, the eighth plague of hail took place. And we see this rhythm happening in each of the plagues. And the first thing that happens is that Moses announces God's proclamation. And he does this normally to Pharaoh. God will send Moses and says, meet him when he goes to his watering hole or go into his council. And Moses will go before Pharaoh and say, thus saith the Lord, let my people go. And if you don't, tomorrow at this time, and there's like specifics, tomorrow at this time, this is what's going to happen in the land. There are always people who are trying to look at stories in the Bible and go, well, this is really just a group of natural phenomena. What you have is you have the river beginning to be polluted, and it has this real reddish tint that is full of all these weird chemicals, and that's not really blood, but it's kind of like blood. And what happened is there is a fish kill, and the frogs kind of flee, and then the frogs die, and so flies and mosquitoes. And the whole point of the story, God uses natural phenomena that has happened on lower levels in Egypt before. These are not foreign events. This is not a comet hitting the planet out of nowhere. These are things that the people had experienced, but on a much lesser level. But everyone begins with Moses saying, let my people go. Pharaoh's heart being hardened, saying, no, I'm not going to let your people go. And Moses saying, then tomorrow at this time, here's what's going to take place. And then tomorrow at that time, Moses does something, lifting his staff, waving his staff, or just saying a word. And then the event takes place. And the plague takes place, and every time it attacks specifically, it shows up in Egypt, while the people in Goshen, which is the Hebrew area where the Jews were living, are spared from the plague. So when hail comes, the hail comes and hits all the fields of the Egyptians and all that, but in Goshen, there's not a thunderstorm. They got blue skies. It's beautiful. When darkness comes, darkness covers, but off in the distance over Goshen, there is light. And the sun is coming through there. And God separates his act of judgment to the Egyptian while he gives mercy to his own people. And so the plague takes place. Sometimes Pharaoh's response, especially in the first three, is to respond with the plague by bringing his own magicians in, his own spiritists. These are people, they are a polytheistic group. And they believe in all these gods. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes, but he's going to bring their priests and magicians and soothsayers in, and they sometimes, the first two plagues specifically, and the pre-plague, which is where Moses goes in with his staff and it turns into a snake, They do the same trick, but then Moses' staff swallows the magician's staffs. And then the first two, they can kind of reproduce it. They can kind of do some trickery and some magic and use even spiritual power to reproduce it. But by the time we get to the third plague, Pharaoh goes to his magicians and says to them, all right, do this one. And they look at him and go, we can't, dude, this is the finger of God. So then Pharaoh starts negotiating. As each plague is happening, Pharaoh starts negotiating with Moses. And in each plague, he gives a little more where it's, I will let your people go, but I'm only going to let the guys go. And Moses goes, nope, we all have to go. I will only let the men and women go, but you have to leave your kids back here and you have to leave your livestock. Nope, we're all going. Well, you have to leave your livestock. And he's always trying to get them to leave in such a way that they have to leave something that will require them to come back. And every time Moses says no, and then Pharaoh's heart again is hardened. This becomes a big issue in the text, because what we find out is God says he is going to harden Pharaoh's heart. And there are several times where we're just told that Pharaoh's heart is hardened. And then we're told several times that Pharaoh hardened his own heart and he sinned in what he did. And we'll deal with what's going on there, because at the end of the day, this is actually the worst judgment in the text. And so we have one after another where the plague is sent. Pharaoh responds by trying to get the plague to stop. Moses then prays. There's actually several places where he looks at Moses and goes, will you go pray for me and pray for us that this will stop? And Moses goes and prays, and the plague stops. And then we start the cycle again with the next plague. And this is repeated 9 times. As Moses goes into Pharaoh, and he does this. And then finally, at the very end of chapter 10, at the end of the 9th plague, which is darkness, Pharaoh calls Moses back in and tells Moses, I will let your people go, but you're not going to be allowed to take your livestock. And Moses looks at Pharaoh and goes, I know your heart is still hard. You don't feel fear of the Lord. And Pharaoh gets angry and says, if you come back into my presence again, if you ever show up, if you show your face here again, I will take your life. And Moses goes, you have your wish, man. I will never see you again. And then we're going to have the 10th plague, which we're going to talk about next week. But this is the rhythm. This is the story, as God acts in ways that no man can take the credit. He acts with power that is totally miraculous, and he is doing some things. And so for a few minutes this morning, what I want to do is I want to talk to you about why. What is God doing in this story? What is he teaching us? How do we take this story and then look at our own lives and our own world and make sense of it? And so what I want to do is I just want to share 5 reasons that God sent the plagues that comes out of the text. We'll read a couple passages. The rest is woven all through the story. 5 basic reasons that God is sending the plagues and acting as a just and righteous judge towards the Egyptians while he acts in grace, passing over the Hebrews. And we'll deal with that in a minute too. And the first one is they demonstrate the purpose of God. They demonstrate the purpose of God over and over and over again in text. That the text says that they will know that I am the Lord. And sometimes the day is the Egyptians. Sometimes the day is the Hebrews. Sometimes the day is Pharaoh. And sometimes the day is us. The text we just read a few minutes ago says, so that people in all nations will know that I am the Lord. And so God is acting in such a way that we can see and behold his glory. We can see his majesty. We can see his power. We can see that he is going to act against injustice and brokenness in the world. He is going to do this. And we see God as a judge. And what we find out in the text is that the Creator is the judge. And so we look at the God of the universe as a judge. And like I said, sometimes if we're religious types, we even like the idea of God judging others, but we don't really look at ourselves and think how silly it is for us to hear something that God has said in his word and literally in my heart go, I don't think I want to do that. And we all do this. We negotiate with the Creator judge. We try to come up with ways to, like, God will give clear commands of this is the way I want you to live we as broken and fallen people are always trying to negotiate him to give himself to our will instead of us looking at our God and going, what you have commanded, that's what I will do. But we don't stop and think how silly it is to know that the God who spun the stars into space and who created all that exists is also a God who is settled to defend his honor, his glory, and his creation. And so he is the creator judge, but the creator judge, we also learn from the text that the judge is the creator. He is the one who made everything. And what happens often is we wrestle with the God of judgment. Like when we come to judgment, we end up with this view that it's hard to get past this view that says he's just up there being really ticked off that people don't like him. And so he's just like mad that people are like not for him. And because he's angry that people don't like him, he's going to get them, right? That's the God. And sometimes religion has kind of created this view of the God who is more of a capricious judge who is just angry and at random points in time pours his anger out just to prove that people ought to get along with him, that they ought to like him better than anything else. And that's not really anywhere in the scripture what's taking place. We need to realize that when we talk about God as judge, he is the judge who is also creator. And what I mean is that he created everything. He created the universe. He created the world we live on. He created us. And in his creation, that means a couple things. It means as creator, he's owner. But he is also the designer. And so when God gives us a command, whether it's about our attitudes, our values, our sexuality, our anger issues, whatever the command is, whether it's about relationships, what we have is the designer speaking into his creation the way it was designed to work. I bought a new pickup truck, right? It's new to us. It's a 1984. That's when I graduated from high school. Where'd that come from? 2004 Ford pickup. We like our pickup. It does not have the little sticker that says E85 on it, though, which means I cannot put diesel in it, and I cannot put E85 gasoline. Well, I can. I can pull up to any tank and put anything I want to. I can put my hose in the gas tank, right? I can do that. But it is not wise to do that because the creator and designer of the vehicle has told me that the only thing I should be putting in that tank is unleaded gas. And it might run for a while on E85, but eventually it's going to destroy the engine. What we have in the scriptures is the creator God who is judge saying, I made the world good. I made it beautiful. I made it and I gave it to my people for their enjoyment. But he says, listen, in this world, I'm the designer. This is the way the world works. And it only really works this way. Why? Because I made it to work this way. And anytime we look at our God and go, listen, I don't care. This is an archaic book. We're in an archaic religion. We have a better idea. We are gumming up the system. It is going to stop running. And we see this in every simple way in our culture, any culture, in my life. Any simple way, I begin to negotiate my way with God and say, I know you said this, but I'm going to do it this way. I begin gumming up the system. And everything starts breaking down. I'll just give you a little simple example. When you're like 9 or 10 years old and you start telling little white lies and getting away with them. And as a parent, I see this in my kids, but I know this happened with me too. And I know, like, why is it a problem? As a dad who loves my kids, why is it a problem? Because I know that when they get away with a little white lie, they're gumming up the system. This does not go well because God created us to love and know truth because we know the one true God, right? You get that? Any command, it's not just the judge who's saying, this is the way it should be. It's the designer and creator saying, I made you to enjoy this life. Anything you do that is against my purpose, the way I designed it, is just going to gum up the system. It's going to make it broken. And the crazy thing is that, like, every theologian who reads this story and like rolls up their sleeves and does the deep end of the study comes to this conclusion. In Genesis chapter 1, beginning with verse 3, it tells us the earth was formless and void, darkness covered the face of the earth, and what theologians say is that this is a picture of chaos. And what happens in the 6 days of creation is God brings beautiful order out of chaos. The designer is designing a perfect world. Every theologian who reads this understands this. This is a picture of God bringing chaos out of order. He is undoing. The creation is being undone against the Egyptians. He is showing us that in this broken world, this is what happens. They have gummed up the system. It can't work anymore. And the very fiber of creation now starts working against them. And see, here's the problem that I have to be confronted with this morning. There's a problem you have to be like. I was back here on stage going, God, have I really dealt with this honestly? We all want a judge, a God who is judge against certain people. We, you know, all joking aside with the screen, we like when they get theirs. And I mean, I teach on Monday nights at Jefferson College for Missouri Baptist University, and I teach this passage. I'm teaching this tomorrow night in my room of 20-something students. About half of them are going to be really frustrated in the fact that there is a God who is a judge and think that is just religious manipulation. But I'm going to look at them and I'm going to look at you and say this: if there is a God, do you want him to get Hitler? What's your answer? If there is a God, do you want him to get Saddam Hussein? Are you okay that the end of Hitler's story, are you really okay with the idea that the end of Hitler's story is that he dies in peace in the arms of his lover? The answer is no. When you hear this, like, just horrible stories of some dude who's molested hundreds and hundreds of kids, ruined their lives, and he gets like a 3-year sentence. Are you okay with that? Or do you want true justice before the true creator for that person? You okay with that? You've already admitted that you want a judge, but here's what we do with this. We say, I want a judge for those people. Let me draw the line where judgment should end. Here I am, the line's right here, right? Get them, but everybody who's on this side of the line, we got to be okay. I don't want a God who judges those people. But our problem is this, that as we wrestle with the purpose of God, I am a person who has been crushed by the injustice in the world. But I have also done injustice that is crushed in the world. As on one side, I want a God who deals with my need for justice, right? But on another side, I need a God who will step into my broken. I realize that there is a God who has to look at me with the same eyes. And God is revealing his purpose as the creator, judge. He is the one. We need to know that he is the Lord. There is none like him. And so the second thing we learn from this story, second reason, is that these demonstrate the holiness and justice of God. That God is acting. He is acting in such a way that he is confronting the injustice and brokenness that has come. And there are 10 plagues, but the hardest judgment, the one that terrifies me the most, is what happens, the judgment on the inside of Pharaoh's heart. Because it begins with God saying, listen, I'm going to harden his heart so that I might display my glory. But it also tells us that Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And so the question is, who hardened Pharaoh's heart? And on one hand, if we try to let God off the hook and say, oh, it was all Pharaoh, we're not reading the text well or the rest of Scripture. What we find is that God is sovereign over every person, every fiber of his creation. He accomplishes his purpose. And I don't understand that all the time, but even in this story, God is going to display his might, and Pharaoh is raised up for this purpose. But the flip side of this is that God didn't do anything to Pharaoh that he didn't want himself. Pharaoh is seen as the god of his world. He is the ultimate deity, and he is not giving that up. And any god, any preacher, anybody who comes and tried to attack that, Pharaoh is going to dig his heels in to exalt his own godhood and the prosperity and the place of his own people. And so God partners with Pharaoh's hardened heart. So the answer is to this question, did God harden Pharaoh's heart, or did Pharaoh harden Pharaoh's heart? The answer is yes. And here's why it scares me, that when I'm confronted with the beauty of Christ and the wonder of the gospel, if I allow my heart to close off, We find all through the Bible that one of the acts of judgment, the greatest, the hardest act of judgment, is that God will partner with me in the hardening of my heart to hear his voice. This is why there are clear commands, don't put this off. Don't put this off. Trust in Christ. Don't put this off. And so you deal with this. And so they demonstrate a God who is settled in dealing with wickedness, but he is confronting Pharaoh with this. And this leads to the next one, and that is that they demonstrate the patience of God. In the text we read in the story, God literally comes to Pharaoh and says, listen, I could have gone from plague 1 to plague 10 right away. I could have cut you off from the face of the earth, but I have not. And in a real way, plagues 1 through plague 9 are warning shots across the bow of a Pharaoh and his people who don't want a God, who want to exalt their own godhood, who want to rule their own lives. And they are warning shots across the bow to say, there is a true God, turn to him. And every time Pharaoh eventually says, I don't know the Lord, I will not serve the Lord, and I will not let his people go. No. And the fact that God didn't go straight from plague 1 to plague 10 is an act of grace. For a lot of us, we've had things happen in our life, and I'm not saying that everything that happens is judgment. I'm being very careful. But God has given us loving, warning opportunities to hear his voice, and we keep ignoring it. And he is patient. And the beautiful thing in the hail thing here, it's in the text, it's beautiful. Moses says, go tell your people to get their stuff out of the field. Get their slaves, get themselves, get their kids. Listen, you don't want your kids playing on the playground. You don't want your dog in the yard when this happens. Get them in the house, because when it comes, anything out is not going to make it. And it says, the people who feared the word of the Lord did what it said. But those who didn't fear the word of the Lord, they stayed out. They were playing basketball on an outdoor basketball goal when the hail came. His patience is demonstrated here. God is not a capricious God. He is a God who is settled against injustice, but he is going to act. Next thing we learn in this story is that these plagues demonstrate the power of God. They demonstrate the power of God. And one thing I don't have time to unpack this morning fully, but I'll just kind of let you know that it's clear in the text and in the understanding of the story, is that we have the Hebrews who are coming saying there's one God, he is Jehovah God, and he is acting in a culture that has created many gods. And the Egyptians were massively polytheistic, and they'd turned everything that they valued and that they wanted into a god. And so they had several gods or goddesses that governed the Nile, and several gods and goddesses of fertility that let them have sex as often as they wanted to, and hopefully insects would have babies when they wanted them and not have babies when they didn't want them. I mean, they literally had gods that they worshiped that allowed all this kind of stuff. And these gods were just a whole pantheon of gods that ultimately every god's job was to serve Egypt. And God keeps saying through Moses, you need to let my people go so that they may worship me and go serve me. But the gods of Egypt were really there so the gods would worship and serve Egypt. And what happens in the story is that every plague actually addresses one or more of the things that the Egyptians had exalted to the place of God. The first plague, the blood in the Nile, renders the gods of the Nile helpless. God proves his power over these gods. The second one is frogs, which is really weird. Why frogs? It really bothers my daughter because the frogs, she's like she loves frogs, and we took her to somebody's, one of our family's house, and they were serving frog legs, and she cried for like 2 hours. Sorry, Alex, had to tell that story. Just had to come out. But she loves frogs. So this whole story of frogs leaving the water and then dying and then stinking bothers her deeply, right? But the fertility gods, and I don't get this. Why would you turn a fertility god into a frog? But the fertility gods was a human with a frog's head. And here we have God attacking. And every one of these plagues is actually addressing specific gods that the Egyptians held. And so when he keeps saying, they will eventually know that I am the Lord, when the 10th round is over, none of their gods are standing, including Pharaoh, who was the personification of all the gods. His line had been broken in the 10th plague. No gods left standing in Egypt. And he's demonstrating his power. And what this teaches us is that as we are people who are idolatrous, God is committed, especially when he's loving us, to not letting our idols stand, to us worshiping and serving the true God. Fifth thing that the plagues teach us about God is they demonstrate the salvation of God. And this will really come out next week. This is like the dark side of a two-part message where we get to the Passover and how God does this. But all through the story, God rescues his people from the same plagues that he sends to Egypt. And our first response would be to look at him and go, well, what we have is innocence versus guilt. But we know that that's not true, because as the Hebrews then go and live their lives, they're just as bad as the Egyptians eventually. And if we know that more than likely, if the Hebrews were the ones in power and the Egyptians, they would oppress them. They would create a situation where they would get power and control and wealth at the hands of anybody else. We know this is true. There is no innocence, but there is grace. That God pours himself into these people and he saves them. And he does this eventually by something taking the place of the people. We're going to talk about this next week. But one of the things I want you to see is that a picture of salvation is being painted here. That God always does justice against the injustice, wickedness, brokenness in the world. Which means that any attempt to get myself out of the crosshairs is a problem. If I'm irreligious and I say, I just don't believe in that God, you better hope you're right. If I'm religious and I think, oh, I believe in a God of justice and he needs to get those people, I have effectively found a way to not deal with my own brokenness and wickedness, to not get myself in the crosshairs. But if I read the text honestly, I realize that this is not enough, and that if I try to side with the Hebrews and make myself the person who's off the hook, there's a problem in the story, because I know my own heart, and I know that given the opportunity, I would have sided with the Egyptians. Which means as I read this story, I'm really supposed to read it knowing that I deserve what the Egyptians get. But he passes over the Hebrews. How does he do this? And what happens? And as you read the narrative of the Bible, the big story of the Bible, and you get to this point, there is another point where God pours out his wrath in judgment, and the story is told to look very much like the plagues. Where all of a sudden, darkness covers the earth. All of a sudden, all the injustice in the world is there and evident. But on that day, God chose to pour his wrath and his judgment on his own son. These plagues help us see the reality of God's justice, but they must lead us to the cross, where the plagues, the ultimate eternal plagues, and the wrath of God is poured out on the injustice and the brokenness of the world, where God says in a very clear way, I will make things right, but I am settled that I will not let evil win. But rather than pouring out his justice on us, he has taken it himself in his son, Jesus, the real plagues of the Bible. There are a true and better plagues too, if you've picked up on the language of the series so far. The true and better plagues happened at Calvary, where Jesus gave his life for you and took what we deserve. This is why it has to produce justice and grace in us. But we must always see that I deserve what's happening. But God has chosen in his grace to pass over. And so what it does is the plagues should not create a moral high ground for us as followers of Jesus to start wishing this on somebody else. The plagues ought to create brokenness and humility in us as we realize that if God had not acted on our behalf, we deserve everything the Egyptians got. And next week, we're going to see that on display in a Passover lamb. But oh, the love of Jesus, who loves me not because of me, who loves me in spite of me, and has chosen to pour his wrath on Jesus that I deserved. Jesus, we love you this morning. We praise you. As the band comes forward and we worship, just help our hearts be lifted to experience the greatness of your grace. Help us realize that you are a God of justice, and to realize that if you don't act, this world ends really badly. but to know that it is your very justice that gives us hope. Gives us hope that the end of this story is that you make everything right. But thank you that on this day we can be in this place and know that the justice that is due us was poured out as the greater plagues were poured out on your own son for us. And when you could have given us justice, you chose to pass over our sins and take them yourself. Help us to rejoice and exult in that this morning. In your name I pray. Amen.